Welcome to the Morning Philip series, co-sponsored with the Bush Foundation and the New Mad Group, hosted at the Garage. The purpose of the Morning Philip series is to discuss philanthropy, civil society, and community. It is an opportunity to have a conversation with good people, doing good things creatively and collaboratively. The format is a conversation, not a pitch, a dialogue, and not a presentation. Two chairs, a table, and a community of interested people. And today we are pleased to have with us a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, a rock climber, and a father. The New Mad Group would like to extend a special thanks to the Cheeseman Center and Wes Brown for sound, South Dakota Public Broadcasting for recording, Scott and Brad for brewing coffee, Barefoot Dance Studios for many of the chairs you're sitting in, Wes and Kelly for setup, the members of the Garage co-working space for allowing us to use your office space, the Bush Foundation, and everyone here for joining us at 7 a.m. For further information about what goes on here, please follow us on Facebook, check us out at garagerapidcity.com, live tweet today at #MorningPhilip. And now with all that, please join me in welcoming David Emery. Thanks for being here this morning. Last night we had what I think ended up being an over 3 hour dinner.
It was, yeah.
Different, it seems like different segments to that dinner as well, different types of conversations. So last night, one of the things we started with, and I think would be great to start with today, is this is your home. You spent lots of time in North Rapid growing up. You actually grew up in Custer, but the Black Hills are your home. And I'm wondering if you would take us back to some of those early memories in North Rapid and share a little bit about your childhood.
Sure. Well, good morning, everybody. I was born here in Rapid City, only lived here until I was about three or three and a half. My dad worked for Black Hills and got transferred when I was about three to Hot Springs. But I was born here. We lived up on Northeast Drive across from Horace Mann School. And then my grandparents lived on Mallow Street, which is kind of under the Silver Street Bridge, you know, north of Omaha there in that area back in there. And they lived there pretty much my whole childhood. So whether I lived here or not, I spent a lot of time there at my grandparents' house. That's my dad's family. So my memories of that really were as a young kid, you know, tearing around your grandparents' house. Not a whole lot different than, you know, how much mischief can you get into in your grandparents' house? But, you know, my grandparents had a very small home. Had a lot of family coming through, usually to or from the reservation. And so they had a very small house, but always had a teepee or a cabin tent set up in the yard. And so as people would come back and forth, friends, family, whatever, they would stop and stay. And so, you know, it was a tiny home. You know, several hundred square feet probably is all. Two little tiny bedrooms and a little tiny kitchen and living room, but it was always full of people. And so, you know, one of my memories there is just, you know, full of folks that you would meet and see, and lots of relatives, again, coming back and forth. All the grandkids always had to be outside. Get out of here. So, we played outside, and we got to sleep outside in the teepee, basically, because there wasn't any room for us in the house.
And the house is still here.
The house is still here, yeah. My grandmother died in the early 70s, like 1971, quite young. My grandpa lived until 1977, but then my dad's older sister lived in that home until about 10 years ago, and the house is still there, so...
So you've shared and over the years an effort that your grandfather had that started, I think, in the 50s to record Lakota speakers and music, Lakota music. Would you talk a little bit about that effort and how he was able to, I believe, travel around the open prairie with a generator trailer, and recording devices to capture Lakota speakers?
Yeah, so my grandfather was born on Rosebud Reservation, and not uncharacteristic of those days, was raised very traditionally by his grandparents. one of whom was Lakota, and she was a survivor of both Little Bighorn and Wounded Knee. And his grandfather was a Scottish guy, McLean was his name. And, you know, he grew up, basically my grandfather grew up bilingual and didn't really know the difference. Mm-hmm. You know, as a kid, I can remember him telling us that he didn't even realize that his grandparents spoke different languages until he was a young kid and they went to a store in Mission. And the storekeeper said, that's the craziest couple. He never speaks a word of Lakota and she never speaks a word of English. And he walked out of the store and said, what are they talking about? And he said he didn't understand. And of course they answered him in two different languages and he didn't think anything of it. But I think the history that he learned, particularly from his grandmother, and the stories, and you know, she took him to those places and showed him those places. He took us. I never went to Little Bighorn with him, but I did go to Wounded Knee with him and, you know, passed on the story that his grandmother told him of where she was and what she did and all those things. I think he realized that a lot of those folks were getting older and dying and he wanted to preserve their stories. And so in the early 50s, decided that, you know, he should buy one of these reel-to-reel tape players and start recording stories. And that really was the origin of what he did. It morphed over time a little bit, but initially it was recording a lot of the people who lived in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, 80s, before they died. And so in his tape collection, people like Dewey Beard, who at one point was one of the only living survivors of both of those two, Little Bighorn and Wounded Knee. He's got hours of tapes of him, for example. Sitting Bull's daughter, Charlie Red Cloud, a lot of other people like that that he recorded. And then as time went on, people would come to him to tell stories or sing songs. A lot of times old family songs. And he would record those. So what started out really as just stories kind of morphed more into music and ceremonial songs, Sundance songs, different things like that as time went on. And then, you know, people would hear about it. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot, people would stop by his house in Rapid City a lot and he would record them. And then he did eventually, because a lot of the smaller communities on the reservations didn't have power in the 50s. And so he rigged up a small trailer that he could pull behind his car with a little portable generator, and then his big reel-to-reel tape players were, you know, that big. They were in a little handheld thing like you have today. And he would haul that around and record people and go to places like, you know, Cherry Creek and Red Scaffold and places like that where, you know, he literally had never seen a tape player before. And then he had a recording studio in his basement. So in that little house up on Mallow Street there, he had an unfinished basement. You literally had to go outside through the garage and back in. And the walls leaked when it rains. But he had a recording studio set up in a corner. And so from basically the floor to the ceiling in that little corner were reel-to-reel tapes stacked on end all the way from just above the floor, because it was wet, all the way to the ceiling, and microphones and recording devices. Mm-hmm. And had a machine, which in those days as young kids we thought was really cool, because it could cut vinyl records. Mm-hmm. From the tapes. And he used to make us, you know, the little ones, like even smaller than a 45. But anyway, so that was something that he did. And from the 50s all the way through until the time he died in the 70s, 77.
Thanks for sharing. This was obviously decades worth of work that your grandfather committed to. In recent years, it seems it's become more and more important to you. Why is that? Preserving those tapes, preserving those recordings of Lakota language important?
You know, when I grew up, all I saw, my grandfather spent literally every spare dollar of disposable income he had and every spare moment. I mean, that's what he did, right? And taught Lakota language as well at the University of South Dakota and other places. But after he retired, he also worked for Black Hills. After he retired from there, that's all he did. Before that, it was every spare moment outside of work. And that's really, I think, recognizing the importance of what he did. I didn't really understand it until a few years before he died. I mean, it was just fun to me, you know, go play with the little records he made and listen to people recording in the basement and things like that. But, you know, understanding the significance of the stories and when he would take us to those places and talk about them, it became much more apparent to me the value of what we had. When he died, my dad was the only one of his siblings who lived close by here. And so we ended up with the tape collection at our house, and the only room in the house that had enough room to store two monstrous trunks full of reel-to-reel tapes was my bedroom. And so I listened to hundreds of hours of tapes, and, you know, I'm not a Lakota speaker. I understand enough to kind of get the general gist of the conversation, and I could understand some of the songs, but spent a lot of time listening to those, and then my dad and his siblings at the time were trying to figure out what to do with the tapes. Long story short, a lot of universities were interested in them, but three of my dad's siblings went to school at Black Hills State. They ended up there. And it went for quite a few years, actually several decades, before really a whole lot was done with them. There would be an isolated instance of someone in the Indian Studies program there who wanted to try to translate a set of the tapes, a particular era or a family or something like that. They might work on them for a year during their course of study, and then that was it for another several years. Finally, about, you know, I suppose late 90s, early 2000 or so, my dad was frustrated still, as was I, that really a lot of people didn't have access to that, all that work. And being great friends with Ruth at Crazy Horse, my folks were for years and years. She'd been kind of pestering Dad about the collection for a long time. She knew my grandfather well, so did Korchak. And she said, you know, I'll make you a deal, and that is I will have them copied basically onto CDs, digitize those, if you let me keep a copy for Crazy Horse's library. And so Mike Morgan, who used to work at KOTA here and was their communications person at Crazy Horse, spent 2+ years, I think, going through, listening to all the tapes, trying to figure out what was on them. Some of them didn't have any English on them, so it was challenging. Some did, at least an introduction of who it was or whatever. Converted them all to disc. And then at Crazy Horse, they had a machine that basically would copy 10 CDs from one CD. And so as Mike would get them all moved over to discs, my dad would go up there and sit and drink coffee and make 10 copies at a time of every disc that Mike made. And so we ended up with, at the end of the day, several hundred CDs full of information, either music or stories or whatever. And then Dad gave a copy to basically all the tribal colleges in the state, University of South Dakota, put a digital copy up at Black Hills State and a couple others. We had one, there was four families, he had siblings, four of them had children, so we made four sets for the family as well. So I have one set in my house, and then a couple of my cousins have their family's respective set in their home.
When you took this position at Black Hills Corp in 2004, the Rapid City Journal quoted you as talking about the importance of the Lakota tradition, specifically the value of generosity, and how and what that means a bit to you, and why it's important that your two sons, that they know about that value. Would you talk about that importance this morning?
Sure. I guess one last little plug for the tape collection. Before we move on, the South Dakota Hall of Fame is in the process of converting those and putting them available on their website, which is really cool. So anyone can go listen to them whenever. I saw Greta here earlier. How many, 50, 60, something like that are out there, and it's an ongoing project. But it's neat because anyone who wants to go listen to them can, in case you're interested. So. the generosity thing, I grew up around my grandparents, and really both sets were not wealthy at all, probably an understatement. My mom was from Leeds, my other grandparents, he worked at Homestake for years. But I think from both families, I learned a lot about just values, I guess. My grandfather here and grandmother, as I said, there was always people at their home. And usually friends, relatives, and others traveling to and from the reservation to here, to Suzanne, or whatever. And a lot of times they'd come by and, they didn't have gas money to get home, or need a place to stay for the night, or whatever. And so I kind of grew up not really thinking about that. It was kind of commonplace. We would go to the old Northside Safeway, which there's a pawn shop there now, on East North there, and that's where my grandparents shopped for groceries, and there was always some people kind of hanging around outside. My grandfather would usually say something to them in Lakota, like, are you hungry, or are you thirsty, or whatever. We'd walk in, and you didn't think a lot about it, but when we walked out, he would hand them something, a sandwich, or bottle of pop, or something like that. So, I think being exposed to that through all those years obviously left an impression in just what you should do, I guess. The other one is just some of the probably more public displays, I think, of Lakota culture, which are things like giveaways and wakes and things where, generosity, I think, is an understatement as to what happens at some of those events and celebrations. And I think it's an important lesson for everybody. And so I was really, really careful when my kids were growing up to expose them to as much of that as I could.
When you run down your resume, you see leadership role after leadership role. What do you believe is the most important characteristic of a leader?
That's a really difficult question. The most important thing. There's many. I've always said I think the most important thing you can do as a leader is be genuine. Mm-hmm. And that includes a whole host of things that get wrapped up in that, right? It's the way you communicate with people. It's the way you talk about things. It's the way you respect others. But it's really kind of being genuine. You have to be who you are. People know if you're not. And relay things in a way that you would want to be related to. I think it's kind of a simple concept, but to pick one leadership trait, it's kind of challenging. But I think that's probably, at least from my perspective, that's one thing I know I can always control. Some of the other things you can or you can't, but the way I act and am consistent with what I believe, I think that's something that I can always do.
Can we take one step further?
We can try.
So, how would you describe David Emery? How would you describe yourself?
Yeah, I don't really like that question.
So let's come back to that. Can we talk about the community?
Sure.
Okay. So you've seen this community over a number of decades. You were just talking about, I think, such a great way about the community that your grandparents had. People coming and going, and that represents so much of our region. What do you think has changed most since growing up and spending time in North Rapid till today?
In my life or in the community or what?
In the community, for the community.
I think there's a much bigger awareness, perhaps, and a discussion of some of the challenges in the community today than there was then. I think people are willing to discuss issues and challenges that we have as a community, right? The differences in different segments of the community and the conflicts between different segments of the community. those things. I think there's a better awareness, at least a better willingness to sit down and discuss things. Right? How much progress we've made, I think we've made a lot of progress in small steps. But a lot of the same issues that you saw back in the 60s and 70s when I grew up, you still see a lot of those today. Right? The racial divisions, the poverty in some parts of town versus other parts of town, you know, and that's not unique to Rapid City, but I see a lot of the same things that I saw when I was a kid, right? That seem somewhat consistent, sadly. But I do think that we've made a lot of progress in a lot of those areas as well. I mean, I think some of the recent examples, organizations that just sit down and try to address these issues. Right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. You can't solve a problem if people won't sit down and talk about it. We had a great discussion last night about some of these issues. And I think that's an important step, is, you know, recognizing the difference in people and cultures and backgrounds and experiences, and trying to use those collectively to advance the community is pretty important. Much easier said than done. But I do think there's a lot of people in the community doing great work to open people's eyes and cooperate and introduce people to others that they may not have otherwise had the opportunity to get to know. And that's kind of where you have to start, I think.
When you made the decision, to keep Black Hills Corporation's headquarters here, what did you see in the community that wanted you to keep it here versus move it to a larger city?
For one, we were here. I mean, that's an obvious part. Rapid City's got a whole bunch of wonderful characteristics, and then it has some challenges when you look at operating a company that has a very large geographic reach, which we do. Travel and some of those things are difficult. We have to recruit a lot of people who have highly specialized skills. They're not always available in or even near here. It's a challenge sometimes if they've never been in this part of the country, whether it's Rapid City or Nebraska or Wyoming or whatever, you know, the quote-unquote flyover states, depending on where you grow up. It's hard to attract people to here. So those are clear challenges. The flip side is, you know, the people here have a wonderful work ethic. Right? They recognize the value of the area of where we have the pleasure to live, in a wonderful place where we don't really have to share it with that many people, frankly, which is really nice. And, you know, where can you, if you can get employees here and provide good employment and good careers, they'll stay, you know, forever, basically. And so as we looked at, you know, those pros and cons, a little tougher to get people here. Once we get them here, they're happy to stay. And then, of course, we can hire a lot of people from here to begin with. That was a key factor. The ongoing discussion about, you know, could we be better off or save money or have easier times employing people, hiring and attracting people in a larger city like a Denver or an Omaha, for example, where we do have significant operations, it's always there. But I think that, you know, the community itself and the people here and the work ethic that's here, I think far outweigh those disadvantages.
Talking about the growth of the company, you lead the largest publicly traded company in South Dakota, mm-hmm. a company that provides a necessary resource for our community to flourish. The company is 135 years old. When you started in this position in 2004, Black Hills Corp served 62,000 meters or persons in South Dakota and Wyoming. Today you serve 1.2 million in 8 states. To what do you attribute this growth?
Two things. I think one is the utility industry has been consolidating rapidly for the last 20 plus years. So when I started working for the company, there was 140, 150 investor-owned utilities across the country, both electric and gas. Today, either electric or combination, I think there's 47, and there's maybe another 10 or 12 gas-only utilities, so 50 to 60. as a relatively small company in that group of peers, 20 years ago and 15 years ago, for example, it really was about survival, honestly, in order to continue to thrive as an independent company and continue to grow and stay here and continue to get bigger. We had to grow. Had we not, efficiencies and all of those things that our peers around us were doing would put a lot of pressure on our customers here. So the necessity of continuing to grow, continuing to add more customers, getting more and more efficient in how you serve those customers was critical to just continuing to survive as a company. And not only that, but being one of the better performing utilities of that group, because the ones that typically got purchased by someone else were the ones that weren't performing as well for their shareholders. So growth was critical and strong performance was very critical as well. Now the growth itself, I think, was really more of back to that work ethic thing again. I think we did some things that people thought we were crazy for doing. You know, in 2005, we tried to buy Northwestern, which was Montana Public Service. They had 600,000 customers and we had 60. And one of the research analysts, stock analysts, said, you know, this is like a guppy trying to swallow a whale. Right? Mm-hmm. But I think we were comfortable that we could do that. Right? I mean, it's a series of tasks, a whole bunch of them, right? Mm-hmm. But I think we felt like we had the people and the knowledge and the wherewithal to get that done. Now, we weren't successful in that one. But we bought Cheyenne Light in 2005, and then we did a pretty large acquisition in 2008 of four states from a company called Aquila. That was about $1 billion transaction, and that added 600,000+ customers. So it was similar in size to the deal that we tried to do with Northwestern. And then it's recognizing again that when those opportunities are there, you really kind of need to just step up and take advantage of them. And it's having, I guess, the confidence in the people who work with you that collectively you can get those things done, even though they don't really seem possible sometimes. Mm-hmm. And we have a wonderful group of people that are willing to basically roll up their sleeves and do whatever it takes to get those things done. We've had very good success doing it. We've acquired 16 or 17 separate utilities over the last 15 years and integrated them all.
When you mention if Black Hills Corp didn't grow, it could be taken over by another company, a larger one, and that changes the culture or the could change the values or whatnot, the driving force. So how do you place the values in culture when you acquire another company? How do you ensure that the values that Black Hills Corp has extend through the new acquisition and the people that that work for you in the new acquisition?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's much easier said than done. when you acquire, 1,000 employees and you only have 1,000, which when we did our Aquila transaction, that's what happened in 2008, it was a little bit different scenario than where we're at today, in that we really had to rely on the existing leadership and people in those states because we didn't have anybody we could move there.
Sure.
I mean, we just didn't have a deep enough bench. We didn't have that many employees who had been in key leadership roles. And we did that, and I think one of the lessons we learned there is any of the areas where we had any doubts about how quickly our culture would be adopted there versus how long the old one would continue, any suspicion we had all came true for the negative. And that if we had a reservation about a leader and how well he was really going to embrace the way Black Hills like doing business, it almost always proved true. And so after that acquisition, we made a very concerted effort, and I said to the board, we're not doing this again this way. So we started in 2008 and 2009 doing a very specific, very deliberate leadership development and rotation of people and other things within the company to prepare people for opportunities like that. So Source Gas in 2016, when we purchased them, it was another 1,000 plus employees and in multiple states. Black Hills executives filled every key role in that acquisition. And we relocated several and shuffled people around, and that sounds a little harsh, right? Because we had to let some other folks go. But it's a guarantee that you're going to have more consistency faster in the way that you do business, the way that you treat employees, the way that you treat customers, how quickly that you integrate onto common systems and platforms for doing business and all of that, branding, you name it, happens much more quickly that way. And I think the culture gets to where you need it to be faster. That being said, it's still a slow process. Right? You can change the brand on the door, you can change the computer system, whatever, but the way people have been doing things for 30 years doesn't just change like that. Right? It happens through some attrition, it happens through new ideas, but at least you have a consistency from the leadership of what's expected. You don't always get it. Takes time, but you have that consistency. And I think the more recent acquisitions where we've been able to do it that way have been more successful quicker at getting the whole companies assimilated together. It's a never-ending process, though. I mean, we still have challenges in multiple areas.
Thank you. You're a third-generation employee of Black Hills Corp, following your father and grandfather. What do you imagine your grandfather would have to say about the growth and position of the company today? But first, what do you think your grandfather would have to say about you being in the position that you're in?
My grandpa didn't talk a lot. I mean, you know, pretty, you know, stereotypical Lakota elder, I guess. He was, when he said something, you know, he paid attention. And he was very thoughtful, I guess, in his remarks. I would say, obviously, he'd be surprised. And I think, you know, certainly proud. But I think a lot of it is he had a strong work ethic as well. Right? I think he understood that, you know, you needed to work for what you got. Right? And so he would... You know, you never argued with your grandpa about chores. You never argued with him about doing anything, right? It was, he'd say, hey, this needs done, and he would just leave. There wasn't a go do that, or, you know, it just wasn't the way he was. And so I think it was an expectation of his that, and this is true of his kids, my dad and his siblings, is, you know, that you just do your best. At whatever it is you do, it doesn't matter what you do, but do your best at it. And so I think from that perspective, he would be pretty happy. The company, I don't know what he would say, honestly. I think he would be surprised. It's obviously a heck of a lot bigger than it was when he started working here, and very different. But my dad, actually three of my dad's siblings worked for the company as well over the years.
Really?
So not just my dad, but my dad and grandfather retired from the company, but his two brothers worked as linemen when we were building a lot of the transmission lines through the Northern Hills in particular, and then he had one sister who worked as a clerk in the office for a couple of years as well. So all but one of his siblings worked for the company at one time. So it was kind of an interesting twist.
Is that a common story when you, with employees, as you look back, that there's it's a family affair?
There's a lot of families that work for the company. Mm-hmm. I think we went through some periods where a lot of people were families. You know, I can think of families with three or four brothers that worked for us. I see a couple, Fred and some long-term employees here who know those folks and some of those families, Smiths and others that, you know, had multiple brothers and cousins that all worked for us. Then there was a period there, and I think largely because of a couple small isolated bad experiences where we discouraged and frankly didn't let people hire family, at least if they were anywhere near the same part of the company.
Sure.
And we got back away from that probably in the late 90s again, where we said, okay, this is kind of silly. We're in an area where, you know, there's not a lot of people, and it's, we're precluding a lot of really good talent just because of a sensitivity to family issues. Well, you can deal with those, right? You don't let them be in the same reporting chain. You don't let family members be side by side, some of those things. But in general, you end up with even more employees who are really loyal and like working here and that. So I personally, I believe it's much better to allow the relatives as employees.
When you came back to the Black Hills, when you started working for the company, is this where you wanted to end up in this position?
Yeah. I had absolutely no idea where I wanted to end up when I came in this position.
So how does it happen that you're in this position without saying, this is where I want to go?
I'm one of those people, and we chatted about this a little bit last night, but I'm not a person who sits down and says, I want to be here by this time. Right? I just don't do things that way. So from a personal standpoint, my goal is really to kind of follow what I enjoy, if that makes sense. So I came to work here. It's kind of a long story, but I ended up working here. My original plan was I was basically stuck in Texas for the foreseeable future back in the mid-80s, and I was looking to get back to South Dakota. My wife and I were getting ready to get married, and wanted to be in a place where after we got married that we wanted to raise our family and they could be around their family and parents and grandparents and all of those things. So I'd made the decision to stop being an engineer and go back to school at School of Mines and get a mechanical degree instead of the petroleum that I had. And so an opportunity fell in my lap, really, where someone that I used to work with at my prior employer got hired by Black Hills to run their oil and gas operations in the Powder River Basin. And he literally called and offered me a job as I was walking out the door to my wedding rehearsal dinner. And so the plans of quitting, coming back to school, and doing all that morphed literally overnight, or not even overnight, into, well, I'll come back and work in the same field I was in, which was petroleum engineering, but in Wyoming. And so I did that, not really caring, frankly, what the long-term implications of that were. And I knew it was a good company. I'd been around it since I was a kid. I just didn't think I would ever be able to work here in the field I was in. And they bought an oil and gas subsidiary in 1986. And, you know, 3 years later, I think in 89, I started here. And then it was really do your job, do what you enjoy, and do it well, right? Work hard. Both my parents kind of believed the same philosophy of my grandpa. You know, you don't need to toot your own horn. Go to work, put your head down, and someone will figure it out, right? Mm-hmm. And opportunities happened. I can't say I ever, I can't recall a conversation in my career where I told my supervisor I want that job. I didn't have those conversations. They might ask me, you know, what do you think? What would you be interested in doing? And I would do that, but I didn't set my sights that way. I kind of followed what I enjoyed doing. If that opportunity that they mentioned to me was something I thought would be fun, challenging, different, whatever, I did it. Only once or twice did I say, I don't want to do that. But I did that a couple times too, because I didn't think it sounded fun and challenging and that it was more important, again, to me and my family, that I had a job that I enjoyed and a place I wanted to live. And the rest really wasn't as important. You know, as it turned out, obviously, I couldn't have ever sat down and put on a piece of paper that this would be the way it worked out. It was just complete unplanned, you know, pleasant surprise, if you will. But it wasn't certainly a goal to do that.
In this position, what are those things that are fun and enjoyable and challenging?
I like the challenge of, you know, a growing company. I like change, which some people like and some people don't. But I'm a firm believer in there's always a better way to do things. Always a better way to do things. And so I think as an employee or a leader or whatever, it's your job to you do your job every day, all day, you should come up with ways to do it better. Theoretically, you should be the best qualified to figure out how to do your job better. You're the one who does it all day, every day. So I enjoy, you know, how do we get better, you know, that aspect of it. I like the big challenges, sometimes foreseen, sometimes unforeseen, like large acquisitions or big projects, things like that. And I love being able to deal with the employee side of things, you know, the people development, the leadership development, doing employee meetings. We had a women's leadership conference for a group of 140 of our women from Black Hills last week at our office here in Rapid City, and had a lot of outside speakers. I had a great time, you know, participating with that group. So I probably enjoy that piece as much as anything else.
So if you didn't do this, what do you imagine your career would be? What would you be doing if you weren't working at Black Hills Corporation?
I think that question depends on what stage of my life I was in. You know, today, if I wasn't doing it, I would probably have a much different outlook on the alternatives that I would approach, as opposed to like when I started for Black Hills. Right? Had I not taken the job with Black Hills, I would probably have a mechanical engineering degree, and I would be something, God knows what, in this area where I was applying that, either directly or indirectly. At this stage in my career, where, you know, frankly, I don't have to work, I would probably spend a lot more time on, again, things that I just purely enjoy. So I'm involved in, you know, several different nonprofits and a board at St. Francis Mission, for example, and a small school at St. Francis, and some of those things I would probably spend a lot more time doing that. Mm-hmm. Because I would have more time. You know, my time is very precious right now. I don't have much. Wish I had more, but I think at this stage of my career it would be something completely different than what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. If I wasn't working. And I'm doing some of those things anyway, as much as time permits. But I don't like to do things if I can't do them well. And so, you know, it's hard to be involved in some of the things I would like to be involved in just because I don't have the time. And I think when you commit to do something, people depend on you to do it, you have to be able to devote the time to it. And I really struggle if I know I can't, then I'd prefer to not really do it. Mm-hmm. Either do it well or don't do it at all. So.
What do you believe is the best piece of advice that you've been given?
A couple things. One very short, and I think it, you know, the be yourself. Had many people, including my parents, tell me that repeatedly over my lifetime, my grandparents as well. And then the other one, I think, related to career or related to anything is, you know, if you're going to do it right. Work hard. You know, you don't need to be recognized for that necessarily, right? It's the value you get out of what you do, I think, and how that motivates you is what's more important than who pays attention. And I've had people make that comment to me, relatives and even a supervisor over the years. I think it's true. So.
Is there a piece of advice that you've given that you've thought that's the best thing that you've shared?
Very similar, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, very similar. I think especially to employees and young employees, you know, a lot of them are, I want to do a different job, I want to be promoted, I want to be whatever. And I'd say in that situation, it's kind of that same advice. Right? It's do what you do it well, have conversations with your supervisors or others about what you would like to do, but you don't really need to self-advocate. Right? Just go do your work. That speaks what you need to speak. And through what you do, and again, how genuine you are, how well you do things, I think that tells everyone who you are, right? Directly or indirectly. I think it says a lot more than you can say.
Can we go one more on that too? So you don't have to self-advocate, But yet we live in a world that is full of Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, telling everybody what we do and what we eat and and how important we are. So how do you, I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
It's a great question. And I've got a 21, it'll be 22 in a couple weeks, and an 18-year-old. And of course, you know, you have a conversation with them and they do this and go, all the time. And it's an interesting dynamic. And I do see it in our workforce, the difference, right? I think there's this, and you know, I don't have a psychological background, obviously, but I see that this instantaneous need for recognition, because they see their peers continually, hey, I did this, or I got promoted, or I went to Hawaii on a vacation, or you know, I bought a new house or a new motorcycle. It's continual flow of that. Here's what I'm doing now, what are you doing, is the implied question, right? And I think it puts a lot of pressure on people. I don't think it's particularly healthy. It's not necessarily bad as long as you understand that just because someone else has a great thing happen in their life and they want to celebrate it, you don't have to keep up with them. Right? And I think there's a little bit of a sense of kind of an unwritten, unsaid peer pressure, if you will, for kids these days, because they're bombarded by everyone else's accomplishments continuously. And I think it's hard. And so we've seen just a shift in that demographic in our workforce, where they do have much more specific goals and they're much less patient about getting there. Which, when you asked about the advice, is put your head down and do your work and someone will be smart enough to figure out that you deserve to be promoted. Mm-hmm. That's where that comment came from, because I've had that conversation with a lot of them, right? You don't need to worry about what you're posting on Facebook or Twitter or Snapchat or whatever. You're doing a great job, right? Focus on that. The rest will happen, right? We'll have conversations about what you're interested in, things like that in your career, but you shouldn't want something in your job because you think it looks good to others. Does that make sense? I don't think you should. Now, some people might highly disagree with me. I really don't care what others think about, and that sounds harsh, but again, if I'm comfortable with myself and being genuine, it's, am I doing what I think I should do based on my values? And am I staying genuine and true to that? And hopefully the rest will work out. And to me, that's always been more important than really what other people might think about that. And I think the age of the cell phone and the Twitter account and everything, that's harder and harder for kids today to do, because they're just bombarded by this, look at me, right? Mm-hmm. All the time, all day, 24 hours a day.
So knowing who you are and that, knowing those values and being genuine, is a difficult thing. People have to work at that. I'm wondering if you've had a mentor, if there's a mentor or important figures in your life that come to mind this morning that were along the way in that process for you. Was there a mentor or relative?
Several, probably, but multiple family members. You know, my grandparents, all four of them, very much were like that, right? And they didn't have much. What they had, they were generous with, and they worked really hard to get it. My parents were really active, and really active in the community, whether it's city councils, nonprofits, you know, both of my folks were real active. My dad was a state legislator for 12 years, and both of them had multiple different gubernatorial appointments over the years, so very active in the community. Right? What can we do to make things better? So I think there's some great lessons from family there. I had a couple different mentors at work that I probably appreciate more now than I did at the time. Mm-hmm. You know how that goes. A lot of you know one of them, Dale Clement, who was our CFO years ago. I worked directly for Dale, and he had this really interesting style where I used to say it was management by coffee cup, right? And I've told him this, so this isn't anything new, but he would come onto your floor in the building and get a cup of coffee and come sit in your office and talk to you. And after he left, you kind of went, wow, I just got a whole bunch of things to do. and he never told me to do anything. And he would ask kind of leading questions like, hey, have you ever thought about this? And it's like, wow, I probably better do something about that. And it was a great style, I think, in leadership, in that, you know, you as a good leader, you don't need to tell people what to do. You need to trust them to figure it out and think about it, maybe set a general idea or direction. I used to say he would kind of theme drop on me, and if I wasn't smart enough to pick up on that theme, he'd come back the next day. But he never really said, go do this. Mm-hmm. And I think I learned a lot from that style, and I didn't fully appreciate it while it was happening. You know, you're busy and you know, you realize that you just got things to do. And I didn't really appreciate the subtlety there, but I learned a lot more leadership for myself because of that style. Mm-hmm. I had one other person who's now on our board at Black Hills. I used to work for him years ago before I came to work for Black Hills. And when I started in oil and gas was in 1985, and in 1986 the industry just absolutely cratered. And the company I worked for, Union Pacific Resources, when I started, we had like 5,900 employees, and 4.5 years later, we had 1,900. And so we laid people off every payday. And a manager, he was several levels above me, and right before I left, he ended up being my direct supervisor, but I knew him pretty well. John Vering was probably the best manager I had in how to deal with those difficult issues. Right, and I would say the one thing I learned through that whole experience and all those many, many, many rounds of layoffs and all those kind of dark days was probably more lessons in how not to do it than I learned lessons in how you should do it. And he was kind of the the shining example of, you know, this is how you deal with these things. Right? You just sit down, be open and honest with people, be willing to have those very difficult conversations. They're no more fun. The people don't like the news any better, but at least they know it's real. And they heard it from you first. Right? And so I learned some very valuable lessons from him, I think, as well. So.
Just a couple more questions, and we have less than 5 minutes. So the first would be, how would you describe your role in the community as CEO of the largest publicly traded company? How would you describe that role in Rapid City, for Rapid City?
You know, I don't really look at it that way. I would say, as an individual, regardless of what my role is at Black Hills, I think based on my upbringing and the examples I had growing up, it's my role as a person who lives in Rapid City is to be engaged and involved and do what I can to make it a better place. So, is my role different because of my role at Black Hills? I probably have more opportunities to be involved, at least easier, right, for me to be involved. But I don't think it really changes how I look at it. I think collectively all of us have different skills and backgrounds and things we can contribute. That's what we should do. And that's the way I was brought up. So I don't really look at that my role's different because of what I do. I think it's easier for me to do some of those things because of what I do. I might be in a position to influence more because people know who I am or whatever, right? But I guess I don't look at it differently from my perspective. I'd be doing the same things no matter what my job was. I just might have to take a different approach. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. If we go back to where we started this morning a little bit and talk about your grandfather and the Lakota Flag Song, would you share the story of how the Lakota Flag Song was created?
Sure. I mentioned earlier that, again, my grandparents' house was kind of a rest stop, if you will, for people passing through, friends, relatives, whatever. So there was always a lot of people around the house. And my grandfather was always recording songs as well. So they would stop in to record, or he would go there, and it was kind of a continual process. There was a day, this literally was in 1954, my grandpa was at the house of a guy in Rapid City named Clark Little Thunder. His daughter Rosalie lived here for a long time, died not too many years ago, maybe 10 or so, and recorded some songs. And there was a group of Lakota elders there, and they were kind of having a contest of, you know, who can come up with the oldest song that they heard from their grandparents, kind of thing. And Grandpa was recording those, and he found one that he really liked and he had never heard before. Came home, and then later that day, Ben Black Elk and his wife Ella, who were very dear friends of my grandparents and were at the house a lot, were on their way back to South Dakota from Ethity, Wyoming, on the Arapaho Shoshone Reservation in Wyoming. I think they'd been there for a powwow or something. And Ben came, and another friend of theirs, Chris Big Eagle, came by, and they were having this conversation, and Ben said, you know, when we were there, the Arapaho had taken an old, old song, and then they came up with words to it, basically, that talked about the United States and the United States flag, and applied that to the melody of this old song, and they called it the Arapaho National Anthem. And he thought it was a cool idea. And so, long story short, over the course of the afternoon, the words were determined, sang to that tune that my grandfather had brought back from Clark Little Thunder's house earlier in the day, and recorded, sang and recorded in my grandfather's basement for the first time. It was like March 1954. You know, that, and then what happened, of course, in those days, you didn't have tape players, and a lot of the places on the reservation didn't have electricity or radios or anything else. And so it's, how do they spread that kind of via word of mouth, if you will? My grandpa had a bunch of little cards. I actually still have one today, almost like a business card that had the words to, then it was called the Sioux National Anthem. Now everyone calls it the Lakota Flag Song, but had that on the back, and he would hand it out everywhere he went, and then they would teach people the song. And he would play it on his recorder or whatever, and then, of course, Ben and Chris Big Eagle and others did the same thing. You know, now, today, pretty much any time there's some kind of a celebration on the reservation, whether it's a basketball game or a powwow or whatever, that song's sung there.
All created.
Yeah, in my grandpa's basement.
In North Rapid. And I've heard that you could sing the Lakota flag.
I could.
And we're not asking.
There's a key distinction between good and will, but good.
Dave, thank you. Thanks for your time this morning, for the conversation. We have a piece of artwork from the Susie Kappa Arts Center, which we'd like to give you. We hope it finds a place on a wall that reminds you of the community conversation and how important those are. We're also, I just want to recognize, there are Bush Foundation folks here, and they are doing office hours. Thanks for coming. They're in the back here, but they were here all day yesterday. They're here today and with meetings and doing capacity building, but thank you for helping make this possible and these conversations possible. This is the piece of artwork that we hope finds that place in the wall, and we hope it reminds you of the community conversations. Today also, at 12:30 here at the garage until 2 o'clock, Kevin Poulier's piece that won Best of Show in the Santa Fe Art Market will be on display in the conference room. Kevin and his wife Valerie will be here. Please come and check it out before it goes to the Smithsonian in their permanent collection. But thanks for coming, and thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks everyone.